Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the G20 summit underway in China, at which President Obama was deliberately snubbed by his hosts, who extended the red carpet to leaders from Russia, Britain, Brazil, India and South Korea, but forced Obama to disembark from Air Force One via a little used exit in the plane's cargo hold. China expert Andrew Nathan, a professor of political science at Columbia University and author of China's Search for Security, joins us to discuss a more assertive China that is challenging the U.S.'s military presence off its shores and is signaling to the G20 leaders that China is a serious, effective, and reliable player on the world stage, in contrast to the United States that is crippled by gridlock in Washington and could elect an unstable, reckless, and unqualified leader who will further weaken America and undermine its global leadership. Then we'll examine why Donald Trump is closing on Hillary Clinton, having recently cut her lead in the polls in half, and assess why Clinton is not 20 points ahead rather than 5. Lawrence Jacobs, Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota and Director of the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs, joins us to discuss the Clinton campaign's deficit in clear messaging in an election in which everyone knows what Trump stands for, and that is to make America great again and build a wall, while it remains unclear what Hillary Clinton stands for. Then finally, with President Obama and Turkey's President Erdogan in a side meeting of the G20 in China, we will look into what Turkey is doing on its southern border with Syria, attacking the U.S.'s most effective ally, the Syrian Kurds, while apparently in some kind of secret alliance with the Islamic State, whose Turkey's intelligence service, the MIT, is still secretly supporting. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the confusing tactics Turkey is engaged in Syria and what strategic changes are underway as Erdogan improves ties with Russia, Iran and Israel, while relations with NATO and the United States remain strained. And joining us now is Andrew Nathan, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University. His teaching and research interests include China's politics and foreign policy, the comparative study of political participation and political culture and human rights, and he's the author of a number of books, including Chinese Democracy, Popular Culture in Late Imperial China, The Great Wall, and The Empty Fortress. And his latest book is China's Search for Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Nathan.
Thank you very much.
And what do you make of the apparently deliberate snub at the airport when Air Force One arrived in Hangzhou?
It's hard to know whether that event was planned or whether it was carelessness, but it's certainly consistent with the more assertive posture that the Chinese President Xi Jinping has been taking ever since he came to office, sending a message basically, we're your equal, we're big, you, the United States, are overly present in our region of Asia, and you should really yield to us. So China wants to be seen as strong, and this might have been a signal, or maybe it was just an error. We can't know.
Well, but if you extend the red carpet to Russia, Britain, Brazil, India, and South Korea, and not to the United States, and have the president exit Air Force One through the cargo hold, it seems hard to believe that that's a sort of unintentional oversight.
I agree. I mean, the Chinese are very attentive to protocol, and they have plenty of staff, and they plan very carefully in advance. So it is hard to believe. But on the other hand, I'm just not sure, because actually for the same argument, which is that they are very attentive to protocol. So I don't know. But I think your theory of it is reasonable.
So and what about the tone that China is signaling with Xi Jinping saying, telling the world leaders to avoid empty talk and we're getting down to serious business? And the implication, I think, is inescapable that China is more or less saying, look, we're a responsible, reliable world leader. an emerging power. The Americans, on the other hand, have gridlock in Washington, and so much for American democracy, it could elect Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that the Chinese are capable. First of all, they have a very centralized leadership. I mean, that's one of the benefits of authoritarianism, and they're able to, and they have a complicated international situation since they're the number two economic power and the major power in their region. So they're capable of treating different issues differently. So when they want to confront Japan or the United States, South Korea over East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands or the South China Sea, they can be confrontational. When they want to cooperate, as with climate change, they can be cooperative. So I think we've seen both of those. But I think they do assess in general that the U.S. is a declining power. It's declining relatively because the Chinese economy is still growing faster than the U.S. economy, even though the Chinese economy has slowed down some. And I think they think that the U.S. system is inherently or structurally weak. Whether it elects Trump or Clinton, it's still a system with frequent elections, with unpredictable candidates, with a separation of powers where the White House and the Congress are not controlled by the same party. I think they see that kind of political system as kind of crazy. Why have it, in their view? And therefore, that they're in a better position to push their interests.
And again, I'm speaking with Andrew Nathan. He's a professor of political science at Columbia University. His teaching and research interests include Chinese politics and foreign policy, the comparative study of political participation and political culture and human rights. And his latest book is China's Search for Security. But beyond rhetoric, when you talk about the climate change deal that was struck between the U.S. and China, which is certainly a big step, the difference is that President Obama hasn't been able to get very much done in terms of his initiatives, and much of his efforts to wean the U.S. from the CO2 polluting coal-fired power plants has been stalled by the courts, etc. And meanwhile, China has gone ahead and raced way ahead of anybody else in terms of its use of wind and solar. So I guess that ties into what you just said. In an authoritarian country, you can get things done.
Yes, it does. And, you know, China stands to suffer a lot from climate change because of their population density, water shortage, so on and so forth. You know, the Tibetan glaciers melting and all that. So they really have to take a lead in that area. And I agree that their system is more, you know, because it's a dictatorship, it is more effective in implementing the decisions by the central leadership. Although we shouldn't exaggerate that, because they have a hard time actually getting, you know, the lower levels of government have a different set of interests. They have an interest in keeping people employed and keeping social peace and hitting their economic growth targets and stuff like that. So it requires a huge amount of effort coming down from the top onto the middle and lower level bureaucracy to get those people in line. And then they have a sort of macro problem of they need to sustain economic growth. And I think the wind and solar, they see that as an area to get growth. This is the same argument Obama makes, is that if we would, you know, move into investing in these cutting-edge technologies, it would grow new industries. The Chinese have been incredibly successful at seizing the global market in solar panels, for example. So it's a complicated process, but I agree with you that China can implement, maybe not on day two, but they can keep moving in that direction.
So let's focus then on the new assertive China under Xi Jinping, particularly in terms of these islands in the South China Sea that they built bases on. They've moved into places like Scarborough Shoal, which is 100 miles west of the Philippines, because the Filipinos have basically been I think, pretty much bought off by the Chinese. Recently, the Cambodians and the Laos were bought off at the ASEAN meeting to not criticize China over the ruling against it by the International Court. So is there – what do you make of this new assertiveness in the South China Sea? Some people say it's about oil. U.S. oil producers say there's no oil there. Other analysts say it's to do with fish because China has fished out its coastal waters and needs the protein. What do you make of China's assertiveness, particularly in the South China Sea?
Yeah, well, I think fish is important because China, you know, big population, a lot of fish eaters, and all the other countries around the South China Sea likewise. And oil, I think, is something in the long run. It's important, it's there, but it's expensive to recover. And the sea lanes of communication, the shipping, commercial shipping that goes through there. But I think the number one factor for the Chinese is the American military presence. The U.S. has maintained a very, very strong naval and air presence in the South China Sea for a number of purposes to protect the sea lanes and our allies, but especially because the U.S. is pledged to defend Taiwan, you know, from an attack from China. And to make that pledge realistic, the Pacific Command, located in Pearl Harbor, headquartered in Pearl Harbor, the commander of the Pacific Command is responsible for being able to make good on that pledge if it becomes necessary. So he conducts regular intelligence operations along the China coast under the principle of freedom of navigation. And as the Chinese Navy and Air Force grow with the growth of Chinese GDP and then with the reform of the Chinese military, the Chinese naturally want to push that back. You don't want the potential adversary to be freely conducting intelligence operations up in 12 nautical miles up and down your coast all the time. So that's a normal process. And it's a normal process for the Chinese to want to correct that when they have that capability. And I think they've begun to have the capability to do so. So they've taken what I think is a very clever strategy. They haven't triggered a war. They haven't seized the Scarborough Shoal's a little bit different. I'll come to it. But in general, they haven't seized other countries' landforms. They used to be called islands, but the Hague Tribunal has determined that none of them is an island under international law. But these reefs and so on, China are occupied by Vietnam, by Malaysia, by China, by others. What the Chinese have done is the ones they already occupy, they've built them up into larger islands that can sustain military and air assets. And so they're making a point there and creating a capability. In the case of the Scarborough Shoal, there was a clash around fishermen from China, and this kind of escalated, and the U.S. stepped in to mediate it. And at the end of the day, the Chinese ended up having it, but they haven't built anything on it yet. They might do so, or they might not do so. So I think their strategy is to kind of, take the capabilities that they have and make them more and more present in the South China Sea without triggering an open battle, and to hope that over the course of a number of years, the U.S. will sort of reduce its operations in that area, seeking for some stable status quo, and the Chinese position then would come out in the end in a better place.
But in terms of what China is telling its domestic audience, which is, ramping up nationalism and a little bit of xenophobia as well, is quite in contrast to the theme of this G20 summit, which is towards an innovative, invigorated, interconnected, and inclusive world economy. So how do they navigate that? You know, Xi Jinping has certainly turned back the clock in terms of freedom of expression in China. He's told the press that your job is propaganda. He's cracked down on as much as he can on the internet, the netizens. And on the one hand, he's talking about an open, free world of commerce, but a closed world of politics at home.
Yeah. So Xi Jinping is navigating a number of very difficult challenges that it all fit together perfectly. So China's prosperity, which the regime depends upon to survive, is very dependent on the international economy. The Chinese economy is extremely globalized, and it has a lot of export. I wouldn't describe it as a, let's say, Korea-type export-dominated economy, because it also has a gigantic domestic market. But exports, manufacturing for export, is still very, very important. And the security considerations as well that I just mentioned, China periphery, you know, India, Pakistan, Japan, Southeast Asia, Russia, and so on, to have some influence in the periphery to protect China's own domestic situation, its control of Tibet and Xinjiang and so forth. It requires China to use its economic power to try to have good relations with those neighboring countries. So he really does, when he's meeting with the world leaders, the G20, the major part of the global economy, he certainly wants to emphasize cooperation and what you all can get from cooperating with us, because we're rich. It's like Donald Trump, I'm very rich. You know, China has a huge foreign exchange reserve. So that makes sense. But when he looks at his domestic situation, he faces a lot of social groups that he doesn't trust. You know, the Chinese Communist Party is a tiny ruling group. It's a dictatorship. It's, you know, people grumble. The intellectuals, the university students are grumbling. The middle class is looking to get their money and their children out of the country. The peasants whose land is being taken are complaining. You know, everybody's complaining. And I think that the top leadership feels we're surrounded by complainers here, and they don't really love us, which I think is quite true. And even the bureaucracy itself is corrupt, and there's a lot of muttering against the leadership, and even within the leadership, these power struggles. So that's the crackdown part of it. And then I think the patriotism part of it is quite authentic, which is to say, look, you know, you may not love us, you may not have elected us, but look, China has stood up. You know, your life is better now than it was 5 years ago. Let us be in charge, and we're going to make you proud. And I think you do see that, and Chinese people are kind of contradictory, like people every place, in their attitudes. So one is, why are these officials riding high and pushing us around? And the other one is, I'm proud to be a Chinese. I can travel to New York. I can travel to Paris. I can buy things. I can, you know, I don't have to be ashamed anymore, kind of thing. So I think all those complicated currents are happening at one time, and Xi Jinping is, in a sense, riding the tiger, you know, trying to keep on top and keep steering the country forward, which requires him to actually confront a lot of vested interests, the state-owned enterprises that are inefficient, the military, which, although it's more efficient than it used to be, is still riddled with corruption and needs much more upgrading and training. So he's demobilizing 300,000 military to make the military tighter and better, firing a lot of corrupt generals and so forth. So it's a daily, I would imagine, a daily struggle. And it's interesting that in the midst of that, he cultivates this imperturbable image. You know, you see this at the G20. His facial expression never changes. His physical gait, pace of walking never changes. It's like he's some kind of cartoon character or something, as if nothing is happening. And the truth is the opposite. He's in the middle of a hurricane every day, a political hurricane.
Well, I appreciate your analysis here. I guess China's, you know, entitled to its place in the sun. Its history of aggrievement from the West is very real. And there are a lot of hawks over here, I think, are exaggerating China's military posture. You don't think they're out to conquer the world, right?
I don't see how they can conquer next door to them, North Korea, Pakistan, India, Russia. I mean, much right. less conquer
exactly.
the world. And the U.S. has the luxury, if you will, of deploying its troops in around 800 bases all around the world, many of them very small. So that number might seem a bit exaggerated, but still 800 U.S. military installations around the world, 30,000 troops in Korea, so how many, 40,000 American troops in Japan, American base in Guam, which is 2,000 miles from China, and I think 6,000 from the United States. So I don't see how China in the foreseeable future, whatever that time frame is going to be able to deploy troops on any kind of U.S. pattern.
Well, Andrew, Nathan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Nathan, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University. His teaching and research interests include Chinese politics and foreign policy, the comparative study of political participation and political culture, and human rights. And his latest book is China's Search for Security. We're going to take a brief station break and be talking why or assessing why it is that Hillary Clinton is not 20 points ahead instead of only 5. And we know what Donald Trump stands for, which is to make America great again and build a wall, we're not quite sure what Hillary Clinton stands for. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lawrence Jacobs, who's the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his books include The Unsustainable American State, Talking Together, Public Deliberation in America and the Search for Community, and Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Jacobs.
Good to be back with you.
And do you have an answer for the questions that I posed, which is, why is Donald Trump closing on Hillary Clinton, having cut her lead in half? You would think that she'd be 20 points ahead instead of 5. And also, why is it that we know exactly what Donald Trump stands for? You ask anybody, what does he stand for? Make America great again and build a wall. You ask that same question, what does Hillary Clinton stand for? More often than not, you get a deadly silence.
Well, first off, there's no surprise that the race has gotten closer. There are going to be, you know, more than 90% of Republicans, despite all the stories and anecdotes people have. But those 90% of Republicans are going to be turning back to their party's candidate. The situation in the country in terms of the economy and generally the sense that the country's off on the wrong track are not good. And a good number of those people end up voting for the out candidate, and they may not even understand what Donald Trump stands for. So no surprise here. The key thing here about the Politico story you're referring to is they're looking at national polls. And, of course, in America, we have electoral college. You're elected by the states. And the reality is Donald Trump has a very, very steep climb because the electoral map is certainly not in his favor. Now, on your question about what does Hillary Clinton stand for, you know, I think this is a strategic decision on her part that she's going to flip the referendum of this election from are you happy with how things are going, which we know voters are not overall, to do you trust Donald Trump, and make it a referendum on Donald Trump. And, you know, that's led her to really downplay her policy positions, which I think are actually pretty clear and, frankly, probably more progressive than any Democratic candidate in some time.
But do you think then that saying vote for me because the other guy's a disaster, that's an old, tired Democratic ploy? I mean, at the end of the day, if you have to say you have to elect me because otherwise the Supreme Court will be taken over by right-wingers, we've heard that refrain on any of occasions. Isn't that almost like an admission of failure?
Well, I think you're certainly right that saying the other guy's a loser or gal's a loser is an old strategy. But Donald Trump is actually a whole new kind of opponent. And his positions on excluding Muslims from immigrating, his caustic comments about people of color and Hispanics and Mexicans, we've never seen a candidate like this, at least in the modern era. And we've had over 100 prominent Republicans come out against him, a number of prominent business leaders. And so it's a different environment. I think making the campaign a referendum on Trump, looking at the polls, it's not an implausible strategy for Clinton to pursue.
But if she wins the Electoral College, which there's no question that all of the electoral maps that you see when the pundits sort of do their predictions seem to favor her unquestionably. But could we end up in a situation where she wins the Electoral College but not the popular vote, and therefore we're in for more years of gridlock?
We could certainly have a situation where Trump wins the popular vote, but I think it's remote. And there are a lot of reasons for that, one of which is while the margin nationally has narrowed, Hillary Clinton still has a 3 to 4 point lead. And this is very important. Donald Trump does not have a modern campaign organization. There's a whole strategy that's been developed over the last 3-4 presidential election cycles known as micro-targeting and other get-out-the-vote efforts that marry on-the-ground activities with information technology and a vast amount of data on individual voters. Trump is really he's not equipped. And people debate whether that's going to be a 3-point percentage point difference for Hillary Clinton or less. But I think there's a consensus among Democrats and Republicans that Trump's support in the polls may not actually translate into the same level of popular vote.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Science at the University of Minnesota, where he directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. And his latest book is Class War, Economic Inequality, and the American Dream. So what does this say, though, in terms of the down-ballot races, where there's been a lot of talk up until now, until the polls sort of narrowed, that this will be a blowout, that the Democrats will take the Senate and possibly the House? It seems to me that what's shaping up here is, if you notice the recent Washington Post ABC News poll that said that Hillary Clinton was at a record low in her popularities or a record high in those who dislike her, the only person worse off than her is Donald Trump. So you have two unpopular candidates running. Is it possible that turnout will be low and that, therefore, there won't be this sweep of the House? And certainly the House is pretty hard. The Senate is more attainable. What's your think?
Go ahead. I've never thought or seen evidence, frankly, that this was going to be a blowout election. I know some people thought that because they were following the news accounts and they couldn't believe that Trump wouldn't lead to a blowout. But that's actually not what the polls and a lot of other research has shown. I think on the Senate side, the Democrats have an advantage. It does not mean that it's a lock ever. We've always known it was going to be a close race. I think in the House, it was always, frankly, remote that the Democrats would win it back. And that has mostly to do with the distribution of Republican votes in a greater variety of areas around the country, and the fact that there's been gerrymandering that has concentrated a lot of the Democratic votes in certain districts. So to be honest with you, this is about where I thought the race would be at this point. And let me just mention one last thing. Time is running out on Donald Trump. Early voting starts in about 3 weeks. And with each passing day, the preferences of voters begin to lock in. And if Trump is not really made this a closer race in the states by the end of September, I think he's got almost an impossible task ahead of him.
So you don't think then that the hires that he's come up with, like Stephen Bannon, Breitbart, and David Bossy, who was one of the political assassins that was targeting Bill and Hillary Clinton way back before when he was still governor of Arkansas. And Bossy, of course, got fired as the chief investigator for Dan Burton's congressional committee for altering transcripts to incriminate the Clintons. And, of course, he's famous for the Citizens United decision. So he's the deputy campaign person. What's interesting about all of the top people, and we don't know the extent of Roger Ailes' role, but apparently he's quite a presence in this campaign. What we do know is that all of the three top people, short of Roger Ailes, all essentially and probably still are, on the payroll of one hedge fund billionaire, Robert Mercer, and his daughter. So that in itself scares some people, the idea that one billionaire is literally running the Trump campaign, and two, that you've got these, you know, tried and true political assassins who are just ready to sling every piece of mud they can find.
Well, you know, I think those are things that some voters are going to get upset about. But most of the voters who are up for grabs being the key phrase here, don't know that, and they're not focused on it. A lot of, frankly, the voters who are up for grabs, most of them, not that interested in politics, and don't necessarily follow a lot of the even broader issues. Now, you know, maybe that's a commentary about our political system and the kind of debate that's been going on within each party, but that's the reality. So I think the kind of important, you know, issues you're raising, not known outside of a very small number of voters and, frankly, you know, almost entirely progressive voters.
Well, there's no question that this email business about the server and the Clinton Foundation have really given the Republicans an enormous amount of ammunition. The press has gone along with it. And, of course, the head of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, who dumped a whole bunch of incriminating stuff on the eve of the Democratic Convention, is promising to dump a whole bunch more stuff. And there's some serious suggestions that he's getting supplied with dirt from Russian intelligence, who presumably have the means to find out an awful lot of stuff about what's happening over here and who's doing what, given their capabilities. So does that bother you that there might be some...
Well, for sure. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think it's very disturbing. I mean, the fact that the Russians have been playing the role that they have in American election, you know, patriots of both parties ought to be, you know, outraged and concerned about that. That's not something that I think in past years either party would have, you know, tolerated. The role of, you know, WikiLeaks and hacking, you know, again, we're even with the lows we've seen in American politics, and there have been plenty, this is a different environment. My hunch is after the election, we'll start to get even more details, and it'll be probably as bad as you're suggesting. But, in terms of the outcome of this election, I think Hillary Clinton has certainly been damaged by the private web server. I think she also, frankly, made some terrible judgments about setting that up. I think going to Wall Street and asking for money, as I think Bernie Sanders, you know, I think made that case pretty strongly and effectively, was another violation in judgment, and it's hurt her. But coming back to where I started, this election has a cast to it in which Donald Trump is the kind of person is the referendum here. And there are just a number of Americans, including people of color and women, and Democrats and independents who are so far not willing to move the country in his direction.
Well, what I was meaning, though, about Julian Assange was that he's made it clear that he hates Hillary Clinton and has promised there's some more damaging stuff coming. So you don't know what it is and how damaging it could be. But do you think at the end of the day, if you started out by saying that basically Hillary Clinton's strategy is to say, I'm not Donald Trump and he's a disaster, can Trump turn the tables with stuff that's supplied by Julian Assange that's even more scandalous?
Well, I think that's certainly possible. I mean, we have a couple months of elections, so, you know, this is absolutely not, you know, kind of in the bag for Hillary Clinton. But I'm not, you know, we'd have to see what evidence is brought forward. My reading of what's been released so far is it adds more detail, but it hasn't added a new smoking gun. It's added some smoke, I'll acknowledge that, but it's pretty much the same story, which was terrible judgment setting up the private email account and equally terrible judgment in the handle and really negligence in handling the private classified material. But we're not finding the kind of gross law breaking that the FBI also said wasn't available. So again, I think the election, I haven't seen anything that would change the general contours of this election, particularly on the state level, which continues to show Hillary Clinton with a stable advantage in Electoral College and Democrats having, you know, an advantage, though more vulnerable in terms of the regaining a narrow majority in the U.S. Senate.
But just in closing, Lawrence Jacobs, if, for example, the heads of the tickets were Tim Kaine and Mike Pence, I think we'd be having a very traditional election with the Democrats putting their traditional platform forth and the Republicans putting their traditional platform
forth. Absolutely. I agree with you. I think the fact that Donald Trump is, run a campaign based on race and on, kind of scaring lots of Americans about, you know, rape is coming from Mexico and challenging, some basic tenets of American society at this point. He's become the candidate and he's become the referendum. You know, I think most political analysts, including the smart ones in the Republican Party, will tell you that Donald Trump has made it very difficult for Republicans to win. They did have a path to victory, and I agree with that. But that Trump has made this about himself. And he's just in my view, he's out of step with an American, which we're probably going to see, you know, more than 30% of the electorate, people of color. And you add in women and you add in, others who are deeply offended by Trump's racially bigoted campaign. And, you know, that shaped the campaign. You're right, though. If we had Pence and Kaine running, it would be much more of a traditional campaign.
But just in closing, if Trump could do what he did in knocking them all off the island, the reality star knocked off all of the many Republican challenges he had because of his use of television, but he also changed the narrative. You know, it used to be politicians on the news hour on PBS would say, I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague. Now, under Trump, it's you're a scumbag. You know, and so do you think that in this debate with Hillary Clinton, he's just going to change the narrative so much that it'll be a free-for-all where traditional politics and a traditional politician like Hillary Clinton will be at a loss?
I actually don't. I think it's very important
to appreciate that the battle for the nomination of both parties is among a fraction of our electorate, you know, maybe 20%. And it consists of folks who are more progressive than most voters and far more conservative than most voters. And so when Trump was carrying on during the primaries and the debates for the Republican nomination, he was talking to a slice of America. And you hear among Republican analysts this talk about Trump pivoting to the for the general election to a broader electorate. And he's you can see him struggling to do it, but he can't do it. And that's why I think his strategy of kind of going back to, you know, these kind of eviscerating attacks and racial politics is doomed, because that's just not where America is at this point.
Well, Lawrence Jacobs, I thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Take
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Jacobs, who is the Walter F. and Joan Mondale Chair of Political Studies at the University of Minnesota, where he also directs the Center for the Study of Politics and Governance at the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Political Affairs. His latest book is Class War, Economic Inequality and the American Dream. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Turkey is attacking the U.S.'s most effective ally, the Syrian Kurds, while apparently in some kind of secret alliance with the Islamic State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former Vice Chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, and he's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades, and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And there's a lot of talk in the Middle East about Erdogan seeing himself as the new Sultan and having these grandiose visions. We know that he built that massive palace for himself in Ankara, and there's no question that he has a considerable ego. But do you think that going along with that, there is this idea of that he has ambitions, not just to be the Sultan, but also the head of a new caliphate?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to remember that people were accusing Erdogan five, six, 7 years ago of being the new Turkish Sultan and trying to recreate the Ottoman Empire and all of that. So this is not entirely new. It's just being resuscitated a bit right now. No, I think if we look at Turkish Islam historically, it has... There's been a very moderate force, by and large, compared to anything we see in the Arab world or Pakistan or so many other places that are so strife-torn. I don't think for a second that he really believes in an Islamic state. I think the idea of restoring a caliphate as such is pretty far-fetched. I don't think most Turks are going there, although everyone recognizes it would be nice to have some sort of central kind of leadership, at least theological leadership, or some, you know, somebody like the Pope or the Dalai Lama, or that could speak for Islam. But that's way down the road. I think he's now balancing, juggling any number of balls in the air, which makes it very difficult to decide which is the real Erdogan. And I think, in a way, they're all part of the real Erdogan agenda, but not an Islamic caliphate.
Well, at the G20 meeting in China, and in a side meeting between President Obama and Turkish President Erdogan, Erdogan urged Obama to join forces in the fight against terrorism. And of course, without distinguishing, you know, in the old, what one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist, that seems to be the case here. You know, there's no good terrorist or bad terrorist. Every kind of terrorism is bad, says Erdogan. Is this going to ameliorate the concerns that the U.S. has that, as we speak, Turkey is beating up on America's most effective ally against the Islamic State, the Syrian Kurds, and that has been going on for some time? And that, you know, clearly it looks as if Vice President Biden got played when he went to meet with Erdogan and seemed to get an agreement out of Erdogan that he was just going to do a minor move on the border against the Islamic State, when instead he turned his tanks on America's proxy.
Right. Well, as I say, I think this is part of a very complex agenda that he's trying to work simultaneously, and we see one day one element stronger than another element. But those, one of the major elements is that he has got that he's very worried about Kurdish separatism. Actually, ironically, Erdogan himself, about 5, 6, 7 years ago, had made greater progress towards acknowledging the Kurdish reality within Turkey and had opened up some very encouraging negotiations with the Kurds. But that has sort of fallen by the wayside due to politics and other things. And now, as you know, he's very concerned that with Syrian Kurds fighting very effectively against ISIS, and certainly the Pentagon's attention has been heavily attracted to that. It seems to be, from an American perspective, the only rational and moderate group in the area. Erdogan's very, very nervous about that, but he's got to get along with the U.S. He doesn't want to completely break ties with the U.S., although he's not going to. We should never think that he's going to go along with the American game plan for the Middle East. That's done and gone forever, even if Erdogan goes. But he's got to get along with the U.S. He doesn't really want to leave NATO, although he may make some noises about that, just to keep Europe on edge. He's got to get along. He's got to get back into having good relations with neighbors who were alienated by Erdogan's Syrian policy. You remember, if you think back 5 years, Turkey was on this whole thing of good neighbor relations with everybody, and it was really working. And suddenly the Syrian situation came along, and he bet heavily on overthrowing Assad, and all of his good relations disappeared. He's now trying to claw his way back, to now restore relations with Russia, restore relations with Iran and with Iraq, and with deal with the U.S. a little more effectively and work closely with China and all of this stuff. There's a lot going on.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University, and he's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly 2 decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. But also at the side meeting at the G20 in China between Obama and Erdogan. Again, Erdogan pressed Obama to give up Fethullah Gulen, who's over here, and extradite him. Erdogan holds him responsible for being behind this failed coup, which I think unquestionably, if you look at a kind of secular religious divide, I mean, you can't help feeling that failed coup has set back the secular forces in Turkey, even though many of them were against the coup. And the one thing about Gulen that I think is so important to understand and is somehow missed in all of this is what a breath of fresh air in terms of Islam his movement was. If you have a reform movement in Islam that basically says to the wealthy, don't spend your money on building mosques and aggrandizing yourself in that way, spend your money on schools and education. Nothing could be more the opposite to the pernicious effect that Wahhabism has had on Islam.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct on that, Ian. But of course, I mean, and they were both allies in the early years of the AKP government. And the first, we shouldn't forget that the first 8-9 years of the AKP government is probably the best governance that Turkey has had since Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder. So it ultimately evolved into some kind of power struggle within the state, and particularly when some of the Gulen supporters were willing to blow the whistle on corruption in high places within the Erdogan government. But right now, as I think it's pretty clear that Erdogan is using this whole failed coup, and it was an outrage. Nobody wanted a successful coup and military coup in Turkey. Not the U.S. Nobody. That era should have long since been long past. But I think he's taken advantage of this incident to now settle with all kinds of enemies within the state, and sweeping arrests and purges and firings and everything else that I think we've talked about before, and it's in the press. So it's really not about Gulen. Gulen has almost become a humorous byword for anything that goes wrong in Turkey these days. You just say, "Oh, well, it's the Gulen movement." He's determined to establish some kind of exceptional autocratic power, even though he's elected and has been repeatedly elected. He's acting as an autocrat, and I think he's using this now to wipe away any opposition, whether it's liberal or conservative or nationalist or religious or whatever. He wants loyalty to himself.
But in terms of while he's reaching out to Russia, Iran, and Israel, ties between NATO and Europe and the U.S. Remain strained. And frankly, my understanding is that Erdogan has whipped up so much anti-Americanism in the press, which he's gradually taking over entirely, just as Putin has done so in Russia. You end up with, a situation where I'm told that if you're an American, maybe you shouldn't travel to Turkey.
Yeah, that is really dismaying. I mean, so many of us have spent so many years in Turkey or visiting Turkey, and it's a magnificent and gifted and extraordinary country, beautiful country. But I'm afraid that he is playing the anti-American card very hard at the moment. He'll play any card that will work. I don't think that inherently he simply wants to dedicate himself to an anti-American posture. But as long as he can, bring out the masses at rallies and find enemies, and Gulen's a very convenient enemy at this point, I doubt that there will be sufficient evidence remotely to qualify to extradite Gulen back to Turkey by normal U.S. standards. So he's a convenient long-term symbol of the American enemy, but it could be anybody else that will be the enemy as long as he can keep the public on his side.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, just turning to the activities of Turkey now in Syria, having invaded and largely spent their time beating up America's most effective proxy on the battlefield against ISIS, the Syrian Kurds. There's no the U.S. and Russia are still haggling over a deal which I guess Kerry just doesn't want to make a deal that Putin is offering. It apparently can't swallow it. I understand that there's also discord between the Department of Defense and state about whatever this deal is that where they've been hovering on closing it, but they still can't close it. Meanwhile, the head of the U.N., their envoy in Syria just says it's never been worse. It's all about death and destruction. There's no serious peace efforts. So are we just to conclude that the agony in Syria will continue, that simply there's too much investment in the various proxies and not enough investment in making a serious effort for peace?
Yeah, I think that's a very depressing aspect of it. As you know, many scholars of conflicts like this talk about the need for the conflict to ripen before you can begin to deal with it. I would hope that we're reaching the point where it's ripened enough. But look, I mean, the basic issue here is Assad worse? A worse alternative, or is a some kind of jihadi, whether it's slightly moderate or very extreme, is some kind of jihadi post-Assad government better? Now, I think for a while Washington and others were, including in the Middle East, were kind of dallying with the idea that any post-Assad regime would be better. Well, I think it's become quite clear over the past couple of years that by no means will any post-Assad government be better. And I don't care if they found moderate Islamists, and there are moderate Islamists, or I don't know, even moderate jihadis, I suppose. But there's going to be a long struggle among them, even if Assad were to be overthrown or defeated. And in that sense, I think the decision is fairly simple. Either go with a very unsavory present regime, which will at least put an end to this hideous civil war and human suffering, and go back to the status quo as it was 10 years ago, which pretty much everybody could live with, or even 5 years ago people could live with, or are we going to go off into some incredible adventure trying to sort out, you know, moderate jihadis, radical jihadis, al-Qaeda, ISIS, all of these people, none of whom, it seems to me, are really in a position to take over the state and run it adequately. And the few real Democrats and few real liberals that are around have been long since just trampled over because they don't have much weapons and they're not good at this game, whereas the jihadis are very good at the game. So I see it as a fairly simple choice right now, but it's hard to swallow it, I think, from Washington's perspective, to admit that it's been a bad gamble. It's been hard for Erdogan. That was Erdogan's gamble. Get rid of Assad, and we'll see then what happens later. Well, we've been there and done that with Iraq and Libya and elsewhere. I just think it's time to admit that this one didn't work, and we better go back to the status quo ante and have to hold our nose and live with Assad.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University and has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades, and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and his latest book is Breaking Faith, a Novel of Espionage and an American's Crisis of Conscience in Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.